going to be studying this evening a topic which is of great interest, because this topic is something which, if you appreciate what this does, then this idea is really a model for the rest of our learning. And it's what it does is it sort of scrapes away the surface of what you regularly see, and you realize that the Torah is infinitely complex and infinitely powerful when you see something like this. And it's a very good reminder that it's much bigger than us. So let's start with that. This week's parasha is Parshas Chukas. This is the section of Torah called Chukas. Happens to be my bar mitzvah parasha, so I have an unfair advantage in the text itself. But it happens to be that there's, interestingly enough, it has a sister parasha. It has a sister parasha in the Torah. Any takers on what that would be? There's another parasha in the Torah, which happens to be the natural partner of Parshas Chukas. Tough question. Where would you turn for that? So you're thinking about Chukim and Mishpatim, but let's think for a moment about the content itself. What lends itself towards the connection with Chukas? And you think, and we're scratching our heads, and we're wondering, and I'm sure, and there must be something there. I'm sure there's some sort of hint. But the moment you see this, it's going to be like a steam train, running at you. It's so obvious.
Not the
Ten Commandments. There's another parallel earlier on.
Paradumas.
Okay, good. So are there any connections to the Torah? Any other times Paradumas discussed in the Torah? Could be Cheder Egel, because there is the notion of the paradigma, the red heifer is some form of rectification of that process. It could be that, but it's something even more obvious, let's say, which is shattering. Let's take it this way. It happens to be that the parasha which is directly parallel to Parashas Chukas is two books back in Parashas Beshalach. Beshalach, really? I mean, what's the connection between them? Now, listen. Let's think about the things. Let's take Beshalach and Chukas for a moment, okay? It's a little hard to see just because of the size of the screen, but we'll try to work with it. First of all, it happens to be in the Torah when we get close to the sources a little bit, we'll bring them into interview. Happens to be the Jews in the desert, or at the times the Israelites, only complain about water three times in all the Tanakh. Three times in all the Tanakh are the times they complain about water. Twice in Parshas Beshalach, immediately when they leave the Red Sea. And then the third time, it happens to be when Miriam dies in Parshas Chukas. So only three times in the entire Torah do they... It sounds like they're complaining all the time, yes, I know, but about water, it only happens three times, and that's twice in Beshalach and once in Chukas. Okay, let's take a little further. What else do we have? The pictures are a little tough to see over here. When does the well of Miriam appear in the Torah? The well of Miriam appears... After they complain about water in Parshas Beshalach is when the well of Miriam, the rock, comes out. That's when Moshe Rabbeinu elicits the water to come out. When does that well disappear? Happens to be, of course, Parshas Chukas, when she dies, right? Which is where the opposite end of it is. Let's take a little further. What's the next thing? Moshe Rabbeinu, how does he get the water out of the rock in Parshas Beshalach? He hits the rock, right? Was he supposed to hit the rock in Parshas Beshalach?
Yes.
Yes, God told him to hit the rock. Problem is, it'll come back to Parshas Chukas. He hits the rock again, but... That wasn't the time to hear it, right? Then you're supposed to, what was the option? You're supposed to speak to the rock. And apparently that's very important, right? Because that's a very important, significant difference. But the point is that both you have rocks which are springing forth water, and Moshe Rabbeinu is hitting in both cases, but suddenly they're supposed to be different. Let's take a little further. In Parshas Beshalach, the famous scene is, the biggest part of Beshalach is Shalashira, because what happens is, there is Kriyas Yamsuf. The words are, Az Yashir, Moshe b'nei Yisrael as-Hashir Azaz, right? Said every day in the morning prayers. Now, happens to be that is not the only Az Yashir in the Torah. There is one more Az Yashir in the entire Torah, and that appears in Parshas Chukas. Happens to be that this is the pasuk is almost identical to the one in Parshas Beshalach, with one exception. It leaves out the word Moshe. It's Az Yashir b'nei Yisrael as-Hashir Azaz. Is that interesting? They sing. What are they singing about? Ali be'er en ulad. What do they sing about? They also sing about water. They sing about the water of the well. Now, it's interesting. What happens is that, interestingly enough, the Midrash describes that why were they singing about this well? It's only a very short song. It's about three, four or five psukim. Why were they singing about this well in Parshas Kukas? Not only because it disappears and reappears, but for a very interesting reason. And that is that there were the children of Israel were going northwards, up where Jordan would be today, and they're passing through valleys. Happens to be that one of the Canaanite tribes laid an ambush for them. And so they waited in the tops of the caves within at the top of this valley, waiting for the Bnei Israel to helplessly walk through them and then prey upon them. And the Midrash describes that a miracle occurred, and the valleys collapsed upon themselves and opened up. So that in such a way that the caves themselves, the protruding rocks, squashed the enemy. Enemy dies, and Bnei Israel walks through completely innocently without realizing what they just missed. How do they realize that they were actually saved? So the Midrash says that the limbs and the blood of those soldiers, those potential ambushers, appeared in the water the next morning. Which sounds very similar to, what happened in Christians? When did Bnei Israel know? They came out the other end, and they think, okay, we made it. What happened to the Egyptians? For all they know, they could be coming round the ocean. We don't know where they are. How do they know that they're dead? Is because suddenly their bodies are swept up to the dry shore. That's when they started singing Oz Yashir. When does the Oz Yashir in Chukas start? Starts with Oz Yashir when they actually see that they had somehow actually survived potential disaster. Interesting that the two Oz Yashirs are connected, right? Interesting. Let's take it a little further. Happens to be, there's the songs in both of them, there's the Shira. Also, in Parshas Bashalach, there is a nation which attacks Israel. That nation is? The nation is Amalek. The nation of Amalek attacks Israel at the end of Bashalach. That's the first occurrence where we have them attacking the poor and stragglers of Israel. Happens to be, there's one other time in the Torah that Amalek attacks Israel, and that's in Parshas Chukas, but I'm not sure, I didn't want to give that away, but what happens is, actually, it isn't in the guise of Amalek. What happens is that it describes that the Canaanite nation comes and attacks Israel, and Israel calls out that if Hashem will give this nation in my hand, then I will pledge all its cities to God. Why were Israel calling out in a general form? Why weren't they saying, give us this Canaanite nation? So the Midrash explains that what is actually happening was the following, is that Amalek wanted to attack, but they wanted to misdirect the tefillahs of Israel. So what they did was, they dressed up like Canaanites, with the hope that Israel would pray to destroy the Canaanites. Their prayers going to the wrong address, because they're not Canaanites, they're Amalekim, another nation, and therefore they'd be able to win the battle, because they realized the first battle, what won the battle was Moshe, Aaron, and Hur on the top of the mountain praying against them. Right, that's what happened. So they dressed up. So Israel sees this nation coming, and they see on the one hand that they look like Canaanites, but when they hear the battle calls, they hear a different language. So therefore, Israel in confusion calls out, "Imitan Hashem es amazeh biyadi," if Hashem gives us this nation in general, because they don't know who it is. What does that mean? That it means to say, interestingly enough, that you have Amalek attacking in the Torah twice. One as itself and one in guise. One in Bishalach, one in Chukas. Then finally, let's go back to the red heifer. The red heifer is talked about in Parashas Chukas. That's why it's called the Chukah of the Torah. It's the unknown statute of the Torah. Happens to be, when was the mitzvah of Parah Adumah given to Israel? Not now. It was not given at the end of the desert experience. Or even in the middle of the desert experience. Happens to be immediately as Israel leaves Kriyas Yamsuf. It says that they came to this place called Mara. The water was bitter. Moshe made it sweet. And then Hashem told them a few things. Shom, Som, Loi. There he gave to them Choyk U'Mishpat V'Som, Shom, Nisal. There he gave them statutes and laws. What is the statute? So everybody explains that what happened was that one of the precursors to Sinai itself was learning about the Parah Adumah, which means, where does Parah Adumah really belong? Where does this whole section about Parah Adumah belong? It belongs in Parshas Bashalach. But what the Torah does is it almost extracts it and pushes it later into Parshas Chukas and drops it over here. Which means that the Torah is almost bridging itself by giving us the law, the content of the law, which was historically in the narrative given earlier. Which is the connector over here. And finally, one last thing is, and then we discussed actually, was the idea of Amalek. So I think that at this point in time, I think it just, you know, there are other more subtle connections, but if you look at the content of Chukas and the content of Bashalach, even though they seem to be very different stages of Israel's existence, it seems pretty clear that the Torah is trying to convey to us that there's a connection. Fair assumption? I mean, the Torah seems to be very clearly, and it's very much water-related, it's very much related to Hashem's interaction and with enemies and survival over our enemies. There seems to be some sort of parallel, but they're actually different as well. So now, once you have connections, it's just like all we have is a highway, right? We have now these links which bring the two sections together. The question is, what are we going to do with this? We can smile and say, wow, that's so interesting. Or we can say, okay, let's make some sort of meaning. Let's try to delve into this, try to pull out something out of that meaning, out of that highway. What's the bridge meant to do for us? Let's take this a little further. So let's think about this from the Pauline perspective. Why conceptually would B'Shalach and Chukas be sister parashiyos? Why would they be the natural mirrors of each other? Meaning, if I were to ask you before you saw the connections, why should these two parashiyos be connected? There's another overarching reason why they should be connected. What would that be? What was that? No, you're on the right track. That is? Okay, so here's something interesting. Is the desert experience for Israel... If you think about it for a moment, the desert experience begins when they step out of the Red Sea, because for those 7 days they're running out of Egypt, they weren't in the desert. They were fleeing. They were still essentially Egyptian servants, just on the loose. When did they really become a nation in the desert? Was the moment they stepped out the other side of the sea and they realized that everybody else is dead. Right? That's the beginning point. Happens to be that Chukas is the parasha in which 38 years are bridged in the span of a pasuk. Chukas is we talked about all the things that happened at the beginning, the complaining, the meraglim, and the cheta egel, all the things that happened at the beginning. Then we talk about the Chukas HaTorah, and then boom, in one pasuk, silently 38 years are missed, which, by the way, is a good thing. If it's not talking about it, it means that it was pretty good. It was, you know, we hear about all the bad things, but there was 38 years of silence, which means everything was working as it should have. We have those 38 years of silence, and now we're at the end of the process. There's very little narrative left after Chukas till the end of the Torah itself. All that has to happen after this is the episode of Balak, which, by the way, is almost like a bubble. It's outside the Jewish narrative. It's while Israel's living in the desert, happens to be there's like a side story which is going on. That's the sidebar. But besides that narrative, which could have been concurrent of the 38 within 38 years, there's the Pinchas story, where there's Zimri and the daughters of Midian and Moab, and Pinchas rectifies and they fight war with Midian. That's it. The rest is they're waiting on the east bank of the Jordan, and they're waiting to go into the land of Israel. That's it. Moshe Rabbeinu's speech is 36-day speech, which is in the whole of Devarim. That's the speech. There's no narrative. It's not that they're doing anything at that point in time. You know, he writes the Torah at the end of his life. Within those times, there's not much else going on. Which means to say that Chukas and B'Shalach essentially are the bookends. If you think about it, it's the framework of the desert experience, the beginning and the end, with the exception of the war with Midian. That's all. That's really what's happening. So you'd expect, therefore, that the whole story is framed by two very similar sets of stories, similar but different. It would stand to reason, and tell me what you think. If we could understand the difference between the front cover of the book and the back cover of the book, we could understand what the book was about. I mean, if we could understand what the first page, how the first page differs from the last page or the experience of Midbar, then we could understand what the process of Midbar was. Fair assumption? Now, the Torah seems to be comparing the two. The Torah seems to be making sure it's very patently obvious to us that the two are connected. But if we can now distinguish between the two of them, then we have the means to understand what the book is about. You know, there are some people, my sister's one of those two people who likes to read the first page, the last page, and then ask me about the middle. You know, I'm not that type of reader in general. But it happens to be, we can get a sense of what it's about, or what the Torah is trying to convey to us by understanding the differences between them. So let's start at a very simple place. What is the one most obvious difference between all the incidents that occurred in Parshas B'Shalach and Parshas Chukas? What's the most obvious distinction? Well, not yet. No, he's Aaron and Miriam die in Parshas Chukas, which is actually very noteworthy. But in terms of the incidents themselves, in terms of all the parallel incidents, there's one or two things which are almost identical but different. What would be the most simple place to start? So let's start for a moment. That seems to be a pretty clear one. Let's talk about the hitting the rock. In Parshas B'Shalach, Moshe Rabbeinu is told to hit the rock. In Parshas Chukas, he's told to speak to the rock. And he mixes the two up. And if you think, you know, well, semantics, you know, in the end of the day, he didn't go to Israel because of that. So God didn't think of semantics. Which means to say that there's always a very big difference in the way you relate to rocks. Or there must be something deeper going on. So what's happening over here in the difference between these two? And if we can understand that, maybe we can penetrate what the story in between is about. Now, that's one way of looking at it in this respect. So here we go. The dynamic over here is a dynamic which is called Ma'amar and Makkah. Ma'amar is speaking. Makkah is essentially means smiting, hitting. Smiting is one of those wonderful biblical words that you can use from time to time. So there happens to be those two concepts don't just appear in this context. The notion of Ma'amar, of speech, and Makkah, of smiting down, appear in other patterns in Tanakh. Where else does that dialectic appear? Okay, great. So the plagues are called Makos, interestingly enough, as Alton was saying. The plagues are called Makos. How many of them do we have? We have 10. Where are, now, if we're going to look for the direct opposite, that means to say that we should search and look to find that there should be 10 parallel sayings, right? If this dynamic is to be the same, right? Are there 10 sayings? Answer is, there are. Where were the 10, when there are 10 sayings?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's just be careful. The word over there, for, come on, so I'm going to come back to this in just a moment, is dibur, right? Dibur is a little different to ma'amar, okay? Dibur means to say a commandment, which is more like a directive. A ma'amar is a saying. Now, it happens to be a very subtle difference between the two of them. Before going to dibur in a moment, are there 10 ma'amaras? Order's pointing out that there are 10 makos. Do we have a parallel? Do we have the hitting of the rock? Do we have the speaking to the rock in history? Are there 10 of those, historically?
That's the ma'amaras.
Bingo. So what Lillian's pointing out is we do have 10. There's another 10 over here, which is, if you take a look at the rock over here, there's Ma'amar, where God created the world with 10 Ma'amaras. So here's the mission in Masechet Avos, by Asara Ma'amaras Nivra Ha'olam. The world's created in 10 Ma'amaras, with 10 sayings. How do we know this? I didn't suck it out of the thumb. Chazal looked at the Pesachim, and it says, and when you read through chapter 1 in Bereishis, it says, and a little bit of the next chapter, which was about the 7 days of creation, the Christians put in the chapters, by the way, in the 12th century. That's why the chapters don't always align ideologically with what we have. 12th century chapters are not us. Right? Parashios are us. So that's why you'll notice that the end of the first perek is between day 6 and day 7, because theologically, in the Christian calendar, the week starts at a different point. Interesting enough. We have the 7th day in the fold. Okay? So in the Ma'aseh Bereishis, we have that it says, Vayomer Hashem. Vayomer Hashem Tatshe Ares Deshe, let there be sprout forth grass, let there be animals, let there be aquatic life, let there be humans. All those things are Vayomer. It happens to be that Vayomer appears 9 times in creation. The first one that I understand is Bereishis itself is the context of creation. Meaning to say God catalyzed the process of creation 10 times. There are 10 points where he felt that it was necessary to intervene in creation. Not for now. But it may be interesting enough to actually go back to those 10 points and think about, for those of you who are into science, Stephen Jay Gould's punctuated equilibrium, which is one of the theories in evolution as to the very terse times where evolution expanded at a fast rate and then went back to a normal pace, and where the Ma'amaras come in that. Just for future thought, I'd like to discuss with you afterwards, not the topic here, we don't have so much time for that. But interestingly enough, it says that God created the world in 10 Ma'amaras. Now, then it happens to be the next Mishnah says, or two Mishnahs later says, Asara Nisim Nasla Vosel Ben Mitzrayim, Vasara Alayom, Eser Makos Hevi Akosh Baruch Hu Ala Mitzrayim Ben Mitzrayim. There are 10 Makos which are brought into Mitzrayim. Great. So what I wonder is there a connection between the 10 Ma'amaros, the 10 sayings with which the world was created, and the 10 Makos with which Egypt was beaten down, and do those two relate to our speaking to the rock and our hitting the rock? Can we draw something out of that? Is there something worthwhile that can help us shed light on that? That's the question at hand. It sounds too good to be true. 10-10, but it's the same words, right? Ma'amar and Makkah. Everything sounds good. Yes, let's delve a little deeper. The Ma'aral in Gevuras Hashem, he has essays on a number of different things. One of his books is called Gevuras Hashem, and it relates a lot to Pesach. And he gives a lot of time to Pesach. Very, very eye-opening book. And at the end of it is the Haggadah. He actually has a picture of the Haggadah itself. In one of the later prakim, I think it's about Nun Beis 52, in the 52nd chapter, he talks about, let's see if we have it over here, he talks about how in fact there is a one-to-one parallel. He understands that when God said a saying, he created the world by saying, let's say for instance, Yehi Or, let there be light. What essentially he was doing was the following, is every time he said something, he was clothing himself in a certain veil of creation, that you could now, we as human beings or as creations, could look at and see a tangible part or element of the world and not see him anymore. And what the process of creation was essentially doing was veiling him 10 times to the point where we're left with a tangible world that's in front of us and we kind of think they're independent beings. So we're left looking at this incredible creation, and we wake up and we look at the mountains and the rivers and the trees and the birds and the fish and everything else, and we say, what an incredible world. But we don't realize that in fact that each of those sayings was a crystallization of a certain will of God, which is now hiding him. And if you're canny enough, you can look back into it and say, well, God must be in it, right? If you can look back carefully enough, you'll be able to see the machinations of where those Maamaros really express themselves. It takes a little bit of subtlety. It takes perhaps an Avraham Avinu to look back into the world and say, well, I can discover God by looking back in the reverse of the process that he started itself. So then, if that's true, what happened in Mitzrayim was that humanity was at such a depraved level. They were at such a low level of existence. They weren't able to do that anymore. They couldn't take out the microscopes. They couldn't take out the telescopes. They just couldn't penetrate back into creation to find out God. So you know what that God did? God says, you know what, I'll make it easy for you. I'll peel away creation so you see me. So what he did was, if there was a he or, if God said let there be light, and that was a veil, now you see light as an external source to him. So you know what he says? I'm going to create a plague of darkness. Darkness is now going to rip away that level of creation. It is going to sprout forth grass. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take away that grass. I'm going to take away all the vegetation by the Arabic. And he goes on stage by stage by stage, and he parallels one to one how each of the Makos was essentially doing was reversal of the process of Bereshis itself. So Makkah wasn't, you know, you bad boys. You know, you Mitzrayim, it's boys town for you. What's really happening over here is the Mitzrayim couldn't understand. They couldn't see God. We ourselves, as being a subculture of Egypt, couldn't either penetrate. So what God says, I'm going to give you a lesson. I'm going to show you what creation is really about. To the point where you get to Kriyas Yamsuf and it's obvious. You know, how can't you see God anymore at this point in time? That's what the process of Mitzrayim was. Yes, Mitzrayim was. Mamar is being able to see God when you look at reality and you're able to get the subtleties of reality and see through it and see what's behind it. But sometimes God needs to subdue, break, shatter reality so you say, well, there's nothing else to see. It's clear that God's there. There are two ways, there are actually two modes of interaction of God with the world. Right? At different stages of history. And ultimately, what's better? Meaning, ultimately, what's the better mode of education? What's the better way of seeing God? It's better if God can just relate to us in the way that he wanted us to initially, which is, I've got a creation, and can you see me back through it? Right? Can we wake up in the morning and say, Mode Ani, and see God through that? But at times in history, God needs to say, well, you know, I'm going to shatter it in order to see it. That's sort of like plan B, when humanity hasn't quite made the cut for that generation. So, if that's true, let's think about this for a moment. The Jews, now having walked out of this place of Egyptian culture, and by the way, they themselves are very close to Egyptian culture. When we talk about the Memetes Shari Tzumah that they are on, we're talking about, you know, they are not on, you know, we're not talking about, you know, angelic folk at this point in time. So as they walk out of Egypt, and they're now in the desert, and they're complaining about water, and they have nothing to do, and the taps are dry, and what they're going to do. So they turn to God and they say, we need water. It's been 3 days, there's nothing, we can't help. We lived in great ghettos, and so what does God do? God says, I'll give you water, but you know the mode I'm going to interact with you? You know how I'm going to present that water to you? Tell Moses what's the way he's going to get it? He's going to beat the rock. Why? Because what he needs to do is, we're still at the point of communication with God through subduing and breaking nature in order to be able to see God, because they're not at the stage where they can actually communicate or they can actually look at nature and see where God really is. They have to see it where nature is broken. So what's the mode of communication? God says explicitly to Moses, break the rock. Take, and this is symbolic, this is metaphoric. Take the staff, break the rock, let the water out. Because that's the mode of communication they're at. So that makes a lot of sense. The Midbar process is supposed to be that which allows Israel to be now ready for the land of Israel. Now when you go into the land of Israel, contrary to some popular belief, you actually need to have an army. You need to be able to farm the land. You need to have a government. You need to be able to deal with very basic, and we'll call it human needs, when you go into the land of Israel. And these kind of things require you to be able to have a good sense of God consciousness, that you're no longer at the stage of Makkah. You need to be able to look back into nature and live a normal life, and in that normal life be able to see and reflect God. That's the process what Midbar is supposed to lead them to. So therefore, God says at the end of the process, when they're complaining about water again, because the well disappears, what are they supposed to do? How is Moshe supposed to elicit water? Of course, there's a miracle here, but metaphorically speaking, you're supposed to speak to the rock. Meaning, you need to be able to see that the words of God, metaphorically spoken, are actually where the water actually comes from. That's what you're supposed to be doing here. That's the way you're supposed to be interacting. Then what happens? Moshe Rabbeinu hits the rock. Why does Moshe Rabbeinu hit the rock? What's he essentially saying? What's the argument Moshe Rabbeinu is making at this point in time when he hears them crying and complaining? He was saying essentially that they're not ready. He was saying, Shimuna Amorim, listen to me, you rebellious bunch. That's what he said to them. Shimuna Amorim, listen to me. That means to say, he doesn't feel that they're up to the caliber, they're up to scratch to enter the land of Israel. So what's the response? The response isn't a punishment that he can't go in the land of Israel. He can't be the leader of people going into Israel if he doesn't think they're ready to go in the land of Israel. It's not like, you know, God is slapping him on the hand. God's simply saying, well, if that's where you think they are, then they're going to go in, you can't. Because that's where you think they are. You need to be able to be on the level of Mamar in order to be able to enter the land. Hitting the rock, ultimately, means to say that you're part of the desert experience. The desert experience ended. That's the end of your tenure. That's what's happening over there. You want to take it one step further? You want to take it one step further then? This really pulls it all together. This is really interesting. There's one other difference between the two parashiyos, which is magic. And that is that when you look at the two songs are about two incidents. Song number one in Parashas B'Shalach is upon the episode of Kriyas Yamsuf. What does Kriyas Yamsuf literally mean, actually? Kriya means?
Yeah.
It's to tear, right? It literally means to rip. Okay, so Kriyas Yamsuf is where, what did God do to nature, or the sea in that sense? What was he doing? He ripped it open, right? Here you have a body of water, and God rips it into pieces. Some of the Midrashim say sometimes that there were maybe even 12 passageways in this water. So what is God doing? God is expressing himself by breaking through reality once again. Then what was the song about in Parshas Chukas? What was the episode that the Midrash relates to us, which is only hinted to in Parshas Chukas, is what's called Eshed HaNecholim. Eshed HaNecholim is the tilting of the values. What's the picture? The picture is two parts becoming one. Isn't that interesting? It's the exact opposite of the splitting of the sea. Splitting the sea is when you have one body of water and God's splitting it. When you have Eshed HaNecholim, where the values tilt, it's also killing your enemies. But metaphorically speaking, the picture, the image that we're given, is nature, which is split, becoming one. Because that's ultimately what Ma'amar is. It's where you're saying, I'm going to see God, but I don't need to see God because nature's broken. I'm going to see God because nature's whole. Because within that's where I see God. So ultimately, interestingly enough, in those two particular details, within the differences, it paints us a very interesting picture as what the process is supposed to mean. Right? There's a lot of very fascinating information. I think we just need to just take a step backwards and just breathe in and say, wow, that's really, that's, you know, the Torah really is unbelievable. But it goes further. So let's take it a little further, because just for appreciation, this to me was mind shattering. This was the thought process of a young man who was who gave a little group in Eretz Yisrael at the time I was there, Rabbi Yonah Sclair, fabulous thinker. And many people touch on this in different ways, but this is perhaps one of the most cohesive ways of looking at it. Now let's take it one step further. This is what is interesting to me. If you look at the 10, there happens to be another 10 which was mentioned beforehand, which is Seres HaDibros, right? Which, of course, the word Dibor and Midbar relate to each other, right? The word Dibor is speech, and Midbar also is almost like Medaber, we're like making speech, which is interesting that the two are connected. So you have something interesting. You have 10 ways or steps of Hashem's mode of interacting with the world through speech. 10 steps of interacting with the world through breaking nature, through sort of clearing the screen. And then there's the third way that God interacts with the world, and that's through Midbar, or Dibur. Dibur isn't the same as Mamar. Mamar is, literally, where God speaks and his words crystallize into a form. Right? The word Dibur, it's interesting how the words of God, if you look at the Kabbalistic literature, when people are able to look into reality, into nature, the actual letters of the alphabet, the aleph bays, actually are coalesced into creation. Which means if you have the full sense of understanding what the alphabet means, you can understand the meridians of creation. That's why Sefer Yetzirah, one of the ultimate Kabbalistic books, is just a description of the aleph bays, because there are 22 building blocks. It's almost like the chemical table of elements, the periodic table. If you're able to understand all the elements, you can understand how they fuse together and create every element of the world that we have today. So that's how Ma'amar works. Dibur is not the same thing. Dibur is where, in fact, there is a conversation. Ma'amar is where God speaks and it coalesces. Dibur is where God says to humans, humanity, this is what I want you to do. Humanity, this is what I don't want you to do. There's an interaction. Now, this set of ten is different because in the end of the day, when God interacts with the world through the mode of ma'amar, through speech and creation, the creation process, is he ultimately in the world? Meaning, God said, Yehi Or, there's light. Is God in the world? The answer is, he is. You just need to look hard enough through light. You need to look hard enough through vegetation. You need to look hard enough through inorganic life to be able to see where that ma'amar was, where God was. When God speaks to humanity and says, I don't want you to eat cheeseburgers, is God in the world? Well, yes or no. It depends on humanity. Dibur works where we're actually part of the transaction. So how does God interact with us? How does this mode work? Is when we're listening close enough and we're actually abiding, there's a sense of conversation, there's a dialogue. That Dibur is where God's interaction isn't through creation, breaking creation, it's rather through speaking to the participants within creation. That's the third part of this triangle over here, the other set of ten. Now, this has very interesting ramifications, because what I'd like to argue is the following, is that in each of these three modes of communication, each, whether it be speech through creation, breaking creation, or interacting with us in the world, in each of those there needs to be a balance. And the balance is the following. This is based on the words of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. He has a sefer called Emes Liyakov on Chumash. Really fabulous, really absolutely fabulous work. And he has a very short piece in the beginning of Parshas Va'era, very worthwhile to look through if you're able to. And he has such an interesting thing to say. In fact, it's just context. You know, it's his children who actually run the Yeshiva South Shore. Right? That's Binyamin Kamenetsky and Mordechai Kamenetsky. That's strand of the family. He has something very interesting to say, and that is the father. That in everything that we do, whenever God interacts with us, through whichever mode, and right now I'm arguing that there are three modes, there has to be a balance. And that means to say that when we walk out on the street in the morning, we need to be able to make a choice to or not to believe in God. We need to be able to have an equal possibility to say, you know, God is in our face, God is, and we can bring Him in, invite Him into our lives, or not. There always needs to be a balance. And that means to say that historically speaking, you'll always notice that there is a balance. So here's his example. You'll notice that in the times of Egypt and the times of the early Tanakh, there's an incredible historical amount of idol worship. You know, you talk about polytheism, and I mean it's a soap opera out there. You know, with the amount of you know, the amount of Egyptian gods and the Greek gods. I mean, it's unbelievable how many different forces and powers there are in creation. You kind of wonder to yourself, you know, so what happened? You know, in general, and you know, we don't really go out to the boondocks so much, but the general sense is that we don't meet so many polytheists. You know, right now the statistics are that about I'd say just over half the world's population is in fact monotheistic based on Islam, Christianity. Jews don't really figure into those statistics so much, they're so small. And the rest of it is either atheistic or polytheistic. But polytheism is not more than 20%, which is huge. That's a huge statistic. Which means to say that the world shifted. In those days, that used to be it. That used to be everything that there was. So where did we go? I mean, and the Torah seems to be addressing it. The Torah tells us, keep moving away from what is Torah. Don't do this, don't bow down to that, don't worship this. And we kind of wonder to ourselves, what happened? Happens to be an interesting thing. When did Avodah Zarah sort of stop being in vogue? At which point in history? What was that? Okay, a little earlier than Constantine. Constantine, you're right, so interesting, you're making a good point. In the year 300, when Constantine took over the Roman Empire, and then Christianity became the instated religion, that's when sort of there was the shift in the Roman Empire, you might call it the fall of the Roman Empire. But at the same time, a little earlier on, Chazal identify a point as following. When Israel went into exile, first time around, first Beis Hamikdash wasn't very good, they went into exile, they went into Babylon, and they were coming back. They formulated what was called the Anshei Knesset HaGdolim, the Great Assembly. They were going to come back, they were going to reestablish a second commonwealth, new Beis Hamikdash, wonderful. At that point in time, Chazal tell us, as a Gemara in Sanhedrin, and Yilma, that says, Rabbi Deng Straub realized that, look, what got us here in the first place was idol worship. We can't handle this. We know that we need to have it, because we need to have a struggle. We can't deal with the struggle. So it's stacked against us. The odds are too bad. So you know what we're going to do? They asked to remove the Yetzer Hara, that inclination of Avodah Zarah, and it was acquiesced. They were able. The talk's interesting about this fiery figure of a lion which ran from the Holy of Holies, and they were able to capture it. It was very interesting metaphysically what that means. Now, that means to say that they were able to remove that element of our being within our makeup, which is why afterwards the struggle was no longer about which power to follow, but whether there is a power in the first place. That was when Greece was on the rise, right? Which is interesting enough. Happens to be that Vilna Gaon points out that was when the sun set on Nevuah, on prophecy. It was the beginning of the Second Temple that prophecy disappeared. Do you know why? Because as long as you had a very powerful dark voice in the world, then you had to have the very positive, powerful, good voice. Whenever you're going to have God speaking to you, you can go around the corner and speak to not just a wise person, but a person who actually speaks and convenes with God. And you want to know what to do, and he tells you this is what God says. How can you possibly disagree with him? The answer is, well, you walk half a block down, and you see another guy who, you know, rubs together a few bones and pulls out a lot more powerful voices coming from other places, which really did exist. And you would hear other powers in the world. Says Rabbi Kamenetsky, the two were in parallel. When they removed that Avodah Zarah, the Yetzer Hara Avodah Zarah, naturally a Nevuah, prophecy from God, needed to recede, because there needed to be a balance in which form of relationship to God, to humanity, Dibra. Meaning God is no longer speaking to us through the dark forces, he's not speaking to us through the positive forces. We talked about this a little while back. Similarly, you notice, if we go through the Talmud talks constantly about the concept called Shadim, demons. Demons are these half physical, half spiritual beings which are in particular parts of the world, and there's interesting rules about them and how to avoid them, how to overcome them. Very interesting stuff. The Gemara has lots of formulas about it. Now, in general, there are people who complain about this. In general, then it's not such a constant complaint. You know, 311 does not reach get so many complaints about demons these days. What happened there as well? So Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky points out that as the power of good was receding, there was always the power of bad which was receding at the same time. And as you had luminaries who, at the times of the Talmud, the Tanaim, the Amoraim, people who actually didn't have Nevuah, but they had a very incandescent sense of Ruach HaKodesh, then when you spoke to them, there was a real sense of knowing that they were a little closer to the truth. So you needed to have also powers in the world which were equally dangerous to balance that out. As those receded, those powers also started receding. Interestingly enough, now for instance, people like Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa and all the people who could create miracles, you know, that the vinegar burn, all the types of people that had all types of miracles, yes, how could they list those things while there were other powers in the world that existed at the same time in a parallel? Take it one step further. There was an interesting story in the 1920s about a divil. Dibuk is a free spirit, which finds a carrier body, which it's floating in the world and needs to find housing. So what happened? They found this. There was a particular incident where there was a dibuk. The soul it latched upon itself into upon a lady's body, and the Chofetz Chaim was called to exorcise it. And there's a famous story how he was able to pull it out of her baby finger. And this is a well-known story from not so long ago. Says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, until the world will have another person of the magnitude, the spiritual magnitude of the Chofetz Chaim, we won't have another story of the Dibuk. For the simple reason is that it could only exist when there was a person like the Chofetz Chaim to necessitate such powers in the world. What is interestingly about this whole dimension over here is that this is one mode of interaction, where God speaks to us through either prophecy, Ruach HaKodesh, or perhaps leaders who are very clearly connected to the electricity. When you have that, then equally on the other side, there's the dark side, where there's other forms of communication which are real in a diminishing sense, which need to be there because of the balance. If you take it one step further, there's the let's go into the balance of Mako. Mako is where God subdues reality. God takes creation and breaks it. It stands to reason there needs to be a balance every time that occurs in history, which is interesting. Why? When you go to, let's say, the marble, right? I think that if we lived at the time of Babel, I think at the end of that, I think we'd pretty conclusively draw the following conclusion: is don't mess with God, right? You know, at this point in time, God really is in control of the world. If there's bestiality, he kills us, and that's it. Let's not do that again, right? That should be the basic bottom line of experiencing the flood if you get through it. So, interestingly enough, it happens to be that at the Tower of Babel, the Tower of Babel is described as the following. It says that it was in those days that the world was safachas or dvarim achadim, that they had one plan. What was the plan? So Rashi says something interesting. Rashi says, you know what the plan was? They had this theory. They made this theory that this is the reason why they made the Tower of Babel. They made the Tower of Babel for the following reason. And that is that they said that once every 1,000, I think the numbers are 1,565 years, the sky falls on our heads. Let's make a support for that, for those heavens. Okay, sounds pretty interesting. What are they saying? What are they really saying? You know, when you hear somebody say something, you kind of okay. So what's really behind it? What's the argument? What are they saying? If you think about it. Let's think about it from this perspective. If that flood that occurred those few years ago really happened because we were misbehaving, that means to say that it has religious implications. We now have to change our lifestyle. We can't get up in the morning and do whatever we want. That's a little bit restricting, you know what I'm saying? It makes me feel kind of like, you know, God's a little bit too much in my face and my life is like a little bit constricted because of my because of that experience. So you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a scientific theory. I'm going to be able to tell you exactly why that occurred. Because you know what? There's a pattern. There's a pattern once every 1,565 years. That's what happens. It just happens. It's only happened once. We don't want to take chances the next time around. So what we'll do is we'll make supports. But what are they essentially saying? They're saying, we don't want the religious implications of you breaking the world, of that marker, of that taking apart creation, because, you know, that impinges on my type of lifestyle. What are they doing? God says, you know what, I'm going to leave space for humanity to make the wrong assumptions, even when I break nature, even when I speak to them through marker. Another example. Happens to Moshe Rabbeinu is splitting the sea. The Torah tells us that the entire night, there was Ruach Kodim Azar Kol Alayim. There was this incredibly strong easterly wind. Now, why was there an easterly wind? If God wanted to split the sea, it would go like that. Oh, God, the sea could have disappeared. It could have evaporated. Anything could have happened. Why was it that the sea split and there was a wind blowing all night? So, interesting enough, I actually found an article. There was an article recently. Stephen Humphreys, a wonderful Cambridge professor. This is his take on the matter. Let me just give you the quotation. Yeah, in the recent article, a miracle, perhaps, great timing, certainly, argues Colin Humphreys, a physicist at Cambridge University in England and the author of the book The Miracles of Exodus. Because he can prove, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that, in fact, if you just had the right timing and the right parameters, you know what, it is possible that they could have just been standing at the right time and the sea actually split. Because, you know, if you have the tides, and it's actually the time of the month, and it was a particular year, and the winds are blowing in a particular way, you could just get it, and maybe like in a shore wind in a little bit. Right? So now, he isn't so wrong, you know what? Because the Ramban actually says that's exactly why the wind was blowing. The Ramban says that the reason why the wind was blowing was because if God hadn't left the door open for anybody else to see anything else, then how couldn't they believe in God? So you know what God did? God says, I'll leave the wind blowing. I'll keep the fan on. Because then other people later on in history, Mr. Humphreys in 2014, can make the assumption that in fact, and that he wasn't the first person to do it, that it wasn't a miracle. Right? Why does he need that? Because even when God performs miracles, even when God says, he has creation, he has reality, and I'm going to shatter it in your face, we know Hashem needs to leave the door open so that we're able to see it in a different perspective. We're able to also make assumptions which aren't that way as well. Even in Makkah, and with your permission, just a little bit of a time just to come to the third vertice of this triangle. And that is Ma'amar. God relates to us, whether it be in Dibur, whether it be through prophecy, Ruach HaKodesh, or even we'll call it spiritual awareness. He relates to us in Makkah, where he breaks creation. And the third mode of interaction with us is Ma'amar, through creation. Interesting enough, in the last two centuries, what has happened is there's been an incredible explosion of technology. And technology has enabled us to be able to investigate the macro and micro to a level that we've never been able to do beforehand. And at that point in time, you should think to yourself, wow, we should be able to see God HD. This is it, you know. We'll be able to see, whether it be the macro or the micro, we should be able to see God. So, it's interestingly enough, here you have it. On the micro level, just some some statistics. This is from a book called Bill Bryson. He's a scientific journalist called The History of Nearly Everything. Very interesting book, well worth a read. He says the following. Proteins are what you get when you string ammonia acids together. Okay, so he just talks about how ammonia acids form. How proteins form from certain acids lining up. So here's the statistics, okay, just here for a moment. The chances of a 1,055 sequence molecule like collagen spontaneously self-assembling, frankly, nil. It just isn't going to happen. To grasp what a long shot of its existence is, visualize a standard Las Vegas slot machine, but broaden greatly to about 90 feet, to be precise, to accommodate 1,055 spinning wheels, instead of the usual 3 or 4, with 20 symbols on each wheel, one for each common ammonia acid. How long would it take you to pull a handle before all 1,055 symbols came up in the right order? Effectively, that's just the movement between inorganic and organic life, meaning how do acids turn into proteins, which is the basic life form, and this is what's necessary. Even if you reduce the number of spinning wheels to 200, which is actually a more typical number of ammonia acids for protein, the odds against all 200 coming up in the prescribed sequence are 1 to the 10 or to the 269. Which are 260. There isn't a number for we don't have a name for that number. It's too big, right? So basically, at this point in time, that in itself is a larger number than all the atoms in the universe. That's so meaning to say, the jump from inorganic to organic life is so improbable that at the moment, the more we study, the more we realize that wow, God there has to be a ma'amar somewhere in there. Meaning God must have pushed the process a little further to make that happen, right? But at the same time, it's interesting to note that you have the balance. And that is, what is science's answer to that? So you'd expect that the next paragraph, what would he say? He would say, and therefore I go to church every Sunday, right? That's what he'd say. That's what he should say after that. But he doesn't say that, in fact. And he goes on to say, well, what accounts for the wondrous complexity? And he goes on to say, well, maybe some of the wheels were held. And he says, he has a longer idea over here, which is that maybe if you just give it long enough, if you give it billions of years, let's say about 15 billion years, in fact, then what happens is that give it a long enough time that even the improbable becomes probable. So if you give something a long enough time that even though it's very unlikely, it can be possibly, maybe can spontaneously after a little while just assemble itself. That's what science will say, is because we have such a sufficiently long time to be able to do that, because the universe matches up, at least in terms of carbon dating and expansion. Let's take it on the macro level. Macro level, look at the telescopes, we look in these, and we look at the universe around us, and here's just a sense of this. What is extraordinary about it from our point of view is how well it turned out for us. If the universe had formed a teeny bit differently, if gravity were fractionally stronger or weaker, if the expansion had proceeded just a little bit more slowly or swiftly, then there might never have been stable elements to make you and me and the ground we stand on. Had the gravity been a trifle stronger, the universe itself might have collapsed like a badly erected tent without precisely the right values to give it the right dimensions and density and component parts. Had it been a bit weaker, however, nothing would coalesce. The universe would remain forever a dull, scattered void. He doesn't put the numbers in, but actually there are a number of books written on this. There are actually 7 parameters that are necessary for the Big Bang to coalesce, and one's called the flatness problem. The flatness problem is that window of gravity which is necessary to exist. Do you know what the number is on that window? Meaning it can't be too much gravity, can't be too little gravity. What's the number of the space necessary to exist at that moment that the Big Bang is expanding, when creation is happening? Any guesses? 10 to the 64. Okay, 10 to the 64, just to give you an idea, there are 10 to the 81 atoms in the known universe. There are 10 to the 25, I've heard this from Robert David Foreman, there are 10 to the 25 known leaves in the northern hemisphere, in North America. So somewhere between the amount of leaves and the amount of atoms in the known universe is the space, or the window necessary for the Big Bang to coalesce. That's pretty remarkable, and there are another few of them. There are a whole bunch of other parameters that are necessary. So you think to yourself, at this point in time, he said, I should go to church 3 times a day, right? After this. Meaning, when you look at God and you look at the world around you and you say, how could this possibly ever come together? What his answer is that in the next one is the following. One reason that some experts believe there may have been many of other Big Bangs, perhaps trillions and trillions of them, spread throughout the mighty span of eternity, and that the reason that we exist in this particular one is that this is the one we could exist in. As Edward P. Tyron of Columbia University once put it, in answer to the question of why it happened, I offer the modest proposal that our universe is simply one of those things that which happen from time to time. to which adds Guth, although the creation of the universe might be very unlikely, let's make that very, very unlikely, Tyron emphasized that no one had counted the failed attempts. So what happens is, you just have a very interesting thing over here, is as we get more and more, as opposed to the other processes, as opposed to Ma'amar and Makom, which are diminishing, meaning God seems to be speaking to us less in those two modes. In Ma'amar, we seem to be getting like a heightened expression of being able to see God in reality because we have all these tools to be able to do it. At the same time, remember that the door is still left open, the balance still exists. The more we discover, the more questions, the question marks we still have to answer. Age, evolution, all other questions which still come into motion are still necessary components. Why? Because really, essentially, what we're doing over here is that these three modes, this triangle, whether it be Ma'amar, Makkah, or Dibur, are all balanced out. Whether it's balanced in terms of the way God interacts through speech, through His breaking of reality, or through the way we see Him in reality. I hope this is definitely sufficient food for thought, but I hope this is a nice way to end this this particular session, and looking very much forward to continuing next week. I apologize for the extra time. Thank you. Oh, next.